Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibe. This week on Culturetopia, a new book by Anne Patchett. It's set in the Amazonian jungle. Patchett, the author of Bel Canto, has already earned extraordinary reviews for this new book, State of Wonder. She talks about spending time researching in the rainforests. Playwright Edward Albee on the debate he sparked when he said he does not like being labeled a gay writer during an award ceremony for gay writers. And the neurological power of music, how we humans are hardwired to respond to tunes. But first.
Next weekend, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra ends its season with a four-night performance of Giuseppe Verdi's Messa de Requiem. It is a soaring funeral mass written by a man known for his romantic operas. The piece seems to have traces of both romance and religious feeling. Maren Alsop is the musical director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being back, Maestro.
Great to see you, Scott.
And why did you choose to end the season with Verdi's Requiem?
Well, it does sound a little bit morose, doesn't it, to end a season with a Requiem, but at the end of the day, one has the feeling of rejuvenation from this piece. It's a spectacular work, very dramatic, very big in scope, and like everything Verdi wrote, it has a human story to it.
The version we're listening to now, new release on the Resound label, Riccardo Muti and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Let's listen to the opening.
You know, from this very simple, almost understated beginning, emerges one of the great dramatic works of all time.
Do we know what inspired, and maybe that is exactly the right word, what inspired Verdi to write this? Because I gather accounts say that he was not notably religious.
No, I mean, that's almost the irony in it. He was completely unreligious in his life. But when the great Italian writer and iconic figure, Alessandro Manzoni, passed away, Verdi was extremely distressed. I mean, he couldn't even bring himself to attend his funeral, and he wanted to do something to pay tribute to this colleague of his. He'd worked on several libretti with him, and he went to the mayor of the city and said, "I'd like to write something." Of course, Verdi was incredibly famous, and they said, "By all means."
Of course, and even for someone who's not a believer, death will inevitably stimulate thoughts about what do we amount to.
And in a way, I think the text of the Requiem Mass is one of the great stories of all time. You know, I mean, it brings up every existential question that we grapple with. Mm-hmm. You know, is there life after death? What will happen at the moment of judgment? Is there a judgment day? All of these incredibly powerful stories. When the Dies Irae starts, I mean, I remember hearing this piece for the first time. I didn't know it. I was a kid. And when the bass drum began, I think I screamed out loud. It was so, you know, just bone-crunching, terrifying. It just, I think it should take your breath away, you know, like someone's just punching you.
Mm-hmm. together, it's a huge production.
There are a lot of people in this piece. The choir can never be big enough, so we're collaborating with the Washington Chorus, and I think we have upwards of 120 people. We were only limited by the amount of people we could squeeze on the stage. And it's a big orchestra, and it has four additional trumpets who play antiphonally from the balconies, you know, that moment when the trumpet sounds. And
so they're not on stage, they're in the balconies.
Yeah. We have four on stage as well, but then, you know, he has for the surround sound, Verdi, the trumpets calling. I mean, it's absolutely spine-chilling. I mean, he doesn't shy away from the thought that this is not going to be a pleasant experience.
Well, I mean, but that's part of what music does for us, isn't it? I mean, it's cathartic that way, too.
I think so. I mean, you know, everyone will hear this piece differently. That's the incredible thing about music. It's not prescribed. And this piece has so much variety that I think it's a work that everyone can attach too differently and fall in love with different sections, because it's not as though it's all about terror and fright. There are incredibly joyous and uplifting moments. You know, in order for something to really be terrifying, there has to be that glimmer of hope.
Let me get you to talk about the end of the piece, because I think it's startling and will unsettle some people.
Doesn't really feel like things are going to be okay at all, does it, at the end? Hear that soaring soprano above everything. You know, you hear this incredible drama and the fact that it just dies away with the Libra a me.
Is it wrenching to conduct?
I think it needs to be wrenching to conduct, to affect a compelling performance. But of course, my role as conductor is always a balancing act, because if I get too caught up in the emotion, you know, I can lose track of the bigger architecture, and that's my responsibility. But I think none of us can escape the power of this music, especially when we think of the people that we've lost or we may lose, and our own mortality. I mean, there's nothing more powerful than that.
Baron, thanks so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Scott.
Maren Alsop, musical director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, which ends its 2010-11 season with Verdi's Requiem, June 9 through 12. You can hear more of Verdi's music and read Maestro Alsop's essay about Requiem at nprmusic.org.
The work of America's greatest playwrights include Death of a Salesman, focusing on a father and his sons, a mother-daughter relationship in The Glass Menagerie, and the ultimate battle of the sexes between a failed professor, George, and his drunken wife, Martha. That last play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, is easily Edward Albee's most famous. Interestingly, among the plays that have brought Albee 3 Pulitzer Prizes and 3 Tony Awards, none of them are about gay issues, which accounts for a bit of a controversy he got into a little over a week ago. The playwright was recognized as a pioneer at the Lambda Literary Awards in New York, organized to honor gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender writers. In his acceptance speech, Albee said he was a writer who happened to be gay, not a gay writer. And he went on to say,
"Any definition which is going to limit us is unfortunate and goes beyond that and is deplorable."
Although he's expressed that view as far back as the 60s, his suggestion that writing solely about gay themes is a lesser form of literature raised hackles at the Lambda ceremony and within the larger gay community. We wondered if Albee was surprised by that reaction, and we reached him in New York. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
When you're speaking, such as you were the other evening at the Lambda event, you were being honored as a pioneer. It was the Pioneer Award, which would make you, I guess, a pioneer gay writer, right? Which is partly what sparked a debate.
Well, they're not going to call the award pioneer for a writer who happens to be gay. Maybe I'm just being a little troublesome about this, but so many writers who are gay are expected to behave like gay writers. And I find that is such a limitation and such a prejudicial thing that I fight against it whenever I can. You know, 5% of the people in the United States are gay or lesbian. Does that mean that they can only write about gay subjects because they happen to be gay? Should men only write about men? Should women only write about women? Should blacks only write about blacks? Should whites only write about whites? All of that is preposterous nonsense. The whole function of being a creative artist is to transcend the self and the self-interest and have something to do with the anguish of us all.
Although it's not invalid, right, to in fact do that sort of writing.
The only valid thing about it is the prejudice that the majority community brings to all of these definitions.
Meaning that the majority community sees it as a specialized and lesser piece
of... Yeah, I mean, I happen to mention the fact that whenever poor Tennessee Williams is referred to in a review these days, or in conversation either, it's gay playwright Tennessee Williams. Nobody ever says straight playwright Arthur Miller. And, you know, interestingly enough, Tennessee, who happened to be gay, wrote much more convincingly about women than Arthur Miller ever did, who was famous, from his own point of view, for being straight.
Though when you speak of it being limiting, even from the point of view of the majority population, a number of other gay writers took issue with that. You know,
a number of gay writers would, because some gay writers make their careers and their incomes off of being gay writers rather than writers who happen to be gay.
But you still would hold to that that's a big issue.
I don't think it should be an issue. I mean, who goes around talking about the abstract expressionist painters and making a definition or a distinction between those of them that were straight and those of them who were or are gay? Nobody does it. Nobody does it with composers. People only do it with writers, and I find that so ridiculous.
Was there ever a moment when you wanted to write, expand on, say, a gay character and felt at all inhibited from doing that?
I have spent my life fighting for the civil rights of all people I can find who need their civil rights stood for. And this includes so many people, blacks, Asians, homosexuals, all kinds of people whose civil rights are being trampled upon. And it's our responsibility to do this, to be able to try to get a society that doesn't have these prejudices anymore. But I'm not going to limit the subjects that I write about to the lives of 5% of the population. I'm not going to do it because that cuts me off from the woes and problems of 95% of the population. Why should I do that?
There was a time when gay themes were just not on. It certainly took a lot of courage to be open about one's sexuality early in the game, I'd say the 50s and 60s. In that period, and you had one of the most famous plays ever in American theater, and this is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah, and you know that when that play came out, some critics knew I was gay, and they wrote in their reviews that he's probably writing about two gay couples.
Really?
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yes.
Because I know the difference between men and women, and I know the college structure. And that wouldn't have been allowed in college in those days.
So what are you working on now?
I'm writing a play. I'm writing a play. And I don't want to even talk about what it involves. It involves a lot of our social prejudices about a lot of things, none of which, oddly enough, happens to concern being gay. But I do not begin a play with a thesis, and I must now write about this or that subject. I discover that I'm thinking about some people, and I try to find out why I've been thinking about them, and the whole play evolves from people that I'm thinking about, whom I have invented. I mean, I invented them, therefore they exist, and therefore I can put them down on paper.
Edward Albee, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Whether you've read novelist Ann Patchett before or never read her, she's a writer who will take you someplace you've never been. Patchett has by now established herself in American fiction as a novelist of many gifts who can transform unlikely elements into mesmerizing plot, as she did in Bel Canto in 2002, in which she blended terrorism and opera. Now, several other acclaimed books, and almost a decade later, Patchett is out with a new novel called State of Wonder. And Patchett, it is a great pleasure to have you back on NPR again.
I'm very glad to be here.
You know, as I was reading this, I thought State of Wonder is packed with so much to talk about, so many plot lines, and so many fantastic things that happen. It's going to keep book groups happy all summer.
I hope so.
Would you just sort of talk about the beginning, talk about the mission of your heroine, Marina Singh?
Marina Singh is a pharmacologist who works in Minnesota, and she does studies on cholesterol, and her office mate of 7 years, Anders Ekman, has been sent to the Amazon to find out what's going on with a major research project that the company is funding, and while he is away, he dies. So when the book opens, she's just getting the news that her friend has died in the Amazon, and the company asks that she now go down there both to find out what's going on with the drug and to find out how Anders died.
You make the Amazon come so alive. I mean, I could practically smell it. Would you read a description of the Amazon for us, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Her scalp was soaked, her underwear, the ground beneath her feet loosened as streams of water sluiced between the trees. They heard a high whistle piercing through the thunder and wondered if it was their imagination. Imagination played a major role in the jungle, especially during a storm. They stopped and waited until the whistle came again and then a silence. Marina turned her head and saw that what she had taken for a tree to her left was actually a pole. There were four poles, and 5 feet above her head there was a platform, and above that platform a palm roof. Four Lakashi leaned over the edge, watching. Dr. Nkomo looked up, waved, and the four waved back.
Now, the Lakashi are a tribe, a fictional tribe, at the heart of this, but I just want to ask before we get to them, did you go to the Amazon, I kept wondering, to research any of this?
I did. For the first 3 days, I thought it was the most extraordinarily beautiful, fascinating, all-encompassed, gorgeous place I had ever been to in my life, but unfortunately I stayed for 10 days. And by the end, I was pulling my hair out. I wanted to get out of there so badly.
Because you were sick because of the bugs, the heat?
No, it was so claustrophobic. It's just so oppressive. The jungle squeezes in on you from every side, and you can't go anywhere by yourself. You can't just say, I really want to have a moment and get away. I'm going to go take a walk. You can't take a walk unless you have a guide with you, because there are so many little tiny things out there that can kill you.
Which you do a brilliant job of describing. And I just want to get back to Marina. Who is she trying to find? We had started to talk about this secret drug that's being developed for Vogel, and it's being developed by her former intimidating mentor, a 70-something female doctor called Anique Swenson.
Yes. Dr. Swenson was Marina's teacher in medical school, and Marina was both terrified of her, in awe of her, wanted to shape her life in order to please Dr. Swenson. I think this is probably a pretty common case in medical school, in residency, that you have the sort of terrifying overlord and then a group of young students who will do anything to please and toe the line.
She's a great character. I mean, I kind of adored her. She's really crusty. I kept thinking of Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen. I also kind of thought she's sort of like a more benign version of Mr. Kurtz, Joseph Conrad's rogue ivory trader in The Heart of Darkness.
It's true. And a lot of people have been saying, oh, this is Heart of Darkness for women, which definitely Heart of Darkness figures into this book, but so do about five other novels.
I'm really glad you said that, though, Ann Patchett, because if you hadn't said that, I was going to have to call you on that and tell you
Oh, listen, I own up to my plagiarism fully. Evelyn Waugh, Handful of Dust, Henry James, The Ambassadors. It's all in there.
All right. So Anique Swenson's mission, I think we can say this without giving anything away, you let me know. Dr. Swenson is developing a drug based on tree bark eaten by the women of this fictional tribe. Yeah, I mean, you wrote it. And
yeah.
These
yeah.
women are astonishing because they have lifelong fertility. Boy, that struck me as interesting terrain.
That's very funny, because whenever I've given a talk in the last year and somebody asks me what I'm working on, and I say, oh, it's a book about a tribe in the Amazon where the women have everlasting fertility, and the women in the audience gasp and recoil in horror. And I always say, yes, it is a horror novel. But, you know, this is a very isolated tribe. They're cut off from everyone. And these women have no idea that all women in the world don't have fertility forever.
What are you saying about our society here? At first, I thought women, everlasting fertility. Why go there?
Well, it does seem that women want to keep all of their options open forever. So it's a bit of a cautionary tale. I do think there's so much discussion about how you can freeze your eggs, you can get a surrogate, you can have children as late as you want. And this is a story in which I say, yes, you can have children as long as you want, but in fact, it doesn't really look so good.
Marina is also a heroine that I think we'd all like to emulate. She's in her early 40s. She's smart, brave, funny. She loses every gadget and possession she's got, barely ever looks in the mirror. You gave us a reluctant adventurer who somehow thrives.
It's true. She is reluctant, and she doesn't want this to happen to her. There's a moment in the book where she says she prays for this cup of Brazil to pass over her. But she finds out so much about herself. She just does what she has to do. So I think that Marina is a good role model. She's telling us, if you're thrown off a cliff and into an ocean, you're going to figure out how to swim.
You know, I also love the relationship between the two women, the older Anique Swenson, the younger Marina Singh. Anique Swenson tells Marina at one point, the brain is a storage shed. You put experience in there and it waits for you. And I wondered if that holds true for you as a writer, because you put together so many elements, including here in all your novels, I think, and you make a really compelling story where one would think it might not work.
I think that is really true for me, because every single time I'm writing a book, I get to a certain place where I think, I cannot do this. I can't pull this off. And the only thing that keeps me going is the knowledge that I have always pulled it off before. And so that ability must be in me somewhere. The hardest book for me to write was my first book, because I didn't know that about myself. I wasn't sure I'd be able to make it. But now every time I come up against the wall of my own doubt, I think this is that moment where you come up against your doubt and you always push through and you always find your way.
Anne Patchett. Her newest novel is called State of Wonder. You can read an excerpt at npr.org. She joined us from Nashville. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At some point, almost everybody's touched by music, the goosebumps from a haunting score in a horror film, the catchy tune that gets you up and dancing. Now, new research and new technology lets us see what's actually going on in the brain at those moments. In her new book, Elena Manis tackles a number of fascinating questions. Why does music have such power over our emotions? Why is it universal across all cultures? Does music provide some evolutionary advantage? Is music uniquely human, or do we share it with other animals? Is it hardwired? Did it come before language? And can music make us happier, smarter, and healthier? Elena Manis joins us from our bureau in New York. Her new book is The Power of Music, Pioneering Discoveries in the New Science of Song. And nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here. Thank you so much.
And you've been entrenched in music your whole life. You open your book by describing how you grew up in a very musical family, and you spent time as a small child under a piano.
I did. I was very fortunate, I now realize, to grow up in a family of classical musicians. And one of my earliest memories is of lying under the grand piano as my father practiced. And I remember feeling that vibration and just being fascinated, with that physical sensation.
And one of the findings you uncover in your book is that indeed infants, even younger than you were then, infants seem to have musical innate ability.
Well, yes. I mean, there are several studies. There are studies indicating that infants prefer consonants, at least to a certain degree. Consonants, consonant intervals are the smooth-sounding ones that sound nice to our Western ears and a chord, as opposed to a jarring combination of notes. And then there's a fascinating study by a researcher in Germany who analyzed the cries of infants just a few weeks old and found that they contain some of the intervals, some of the basic intervals common to Western music, at least, and some of them would be universal across cultures as well.
Universal across cultures, which, of course, can be said of music as well. You said they have yet to find a culture that does not include music.
That's true. Music, certainly philosophers and thinkers throughout the ages have made note of that and asked, why is that? I mean, what is it about music that seems to strike so powerfully? And but it's only within the last decade or so that scientists have really had the technology and started to really look for hard evidence of how music affects our bodies and brains and what the effects are.
It's interesting. You're talking about the fMRI technology and PET scans as well, which can watch blood flow through the brain and give you an idea of which parts of the brain are being stimulated or in response to various kinds of music or language or anything else.
Yes, they believe that the music uses more parts of the brain, involves more parts of the brain than any other functions that we perform, which is a pretty amazing fact and statement. And that relates to why music has so much potential to change the brain and affect the way the brain works.
Ani Patel studies the relationship between music and the brain. He's the president of the Society for Music Perception and Cognition. He's a senior fellow at the Neurosciences Institute and joins us now from member station KPBS in San Diego. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi there.
And the book describes a scene where you are dancing with a bird named Snowball. How do we get your job?
And how did I get to that point in my life?
Exactly.
So that was emerged from studies we've been doing on how and why people move to the beat of music. We talked about universals earlier in this, and that is one of the true musical universals all over the world. people have cultures have music with some sort of beat that people dance and move to, and they move in a way that is synchronized to the beat. And you can see this in our culture when people bob their head at a club, or they dance, or they tap their foot. And there was it's kind of a funny response. It seems very basic in some way, and yet other animals, by and large, don't seem to have this response. For example, dogs, who've lived with humans for 10,000 years or whatever and have ample opportunity to see us do stuff and interact with us, they don't have this response to music. So was it uniquely human? This was a question that was floating around in the field. And then we saw this video of a cockatoo, a sulfur-crested cockatoo named Snowball, dancing to music in a way that seemed to actually be on the beat. And out of that emerged a collaborative study with the bird's owner, Irina Schultz, who runs the bird shelter in Indiana where Snowball lives, where we tested if Snowball could do this when we sped up or slowed down the music that he listened to and when there was no humans dancing that he could be imitating. And we showed that he did sense the beat and he could adjust his dancing to stay synchronized. It was the first example of another species besides humans that has this response to music. And we believe that it's not an accident that it's a parrot, because parrots like us have the ability to connect sound and movement in a very complex way through their ability to imitate sound. And other primates, for example, don't do that. No other primate can learn vocally. And so we think even chimps wouldn't have this ability.
It's interesting, though. Snowball liked to make eye contact with you when you were dancing, though.
Yes. For him, this dancing is very much a social behavior. We did an experiment where we made sure no one was dancing with him to show that he could do it on his own. But his preference is definitely for dancing with a partner. And in humans, dancing is often a social behavior as well. It's largely something you do with other people.
And I wanted to follow up on that, Ani Patella. There's an interesting point in the book which suggests that researchers about a century ago were very interested in the origins of music, but sort of got distracted, really, into looking into the origins of language over the past 100 years. It's only in the past few years that music's come back into the equation.
Yes, I think the resurgence of neuroscience, or the emergence, I should say, of modern neuroscience research on music with the ability to look at living brains, and as Elena mentioned, seeing just how much of the brain is activated when we listen to music or when we make music has just raised a bunch of questions and brought attention back to evolutionary questions, which were actually originally raised by Darwin in his book on The Descent of Man. He has several pages where he talks about human music, and he speculated that it arose as a courtship signal, much the way that we think birdsong works in nature among our ancestors, even before we had articulate language with words and so forth. And so now there's this very active debate about, is music an evolutionary adaptation or is it something that we invented? And this is now percolating through a lot of the music cognition literature.
Elena Manis, you also described, we're talking about high-tech equipment like PET scans and fMRIs. So there's also some anthropologists in your book who've done some research and found very, very, very old musical instruments.
Yes, American archaeologist based in Germany, Nicholas Kennard, and his team have discovered very ancient flutes, one of which is presumed to be the oldest musical instrument in the world that we know of. And remarkably, this flute, when played, it produces these amazingly pure tones, and the scale that they can play is fairly similar, I believe, to our present-day scale in Western music. And so this adds to the knowledge that music, musical ability and musical interest in music was something that belonged to very early man and possibly to Neanderthal man before that as well.
There's speculation that in the future that prescriptions of music may become more commonplace.
Well, people are doing it. I certainly can't testify that as to its efficacy at this point, but it's certainly something that people are looking at and actually beginning to produce CDs targeting specific conditions such as anxiety, depression. Maybe Ani has some thoughts on that as well.
Yes, what I'd like to point out is that there's a kind of basic difference between using music as a listening kind of therapy for helping people relax and soothe emotions and lower stress. And music is an active therapy in terms of music making. There's actually a researcher in Germany, Eckhard Altenmüller, who has an institute for music and medicine at the University of Hanover, and he's very interested in how musical exercises can help people regain motor control after stroke. And he's shown through some very interesting studies that by learning to play a musical instrument, even a former non-musician who has weakness in a limb after stroke can regain a lot of dexterity and motor skills, and even more so than by doing the traditional kinds of motor therapies that are done after stroke, because music demands very precise motor skills, and it can be scaled. So you can start with very simple things like beating a drum and then work your way up towards playing short passages on a piano. And these things are, patients find this sort of enjoyable, as opposed to, say, tying your shoes or buttoning a button or things that are kind of boring and frustrating even when you have had a stroke.
Ani Patel is president of the Society for Music Perception and Cognition and wrote the foreword to Elena Manis's book, The Power of Music, Pioneering Discoveries in the New Science of Song. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I have to say, we have several emails along these lines. Emily in Cincinnati wrote us, is there any research on the effects of music on autism? I'm aware of music therapy for autistic individuals and others with mental disabilities. Does anyone know why or how that works?
Ani, do you want to
I can just jump in briefly, and then you can mention your ideas, too. I would just point this listener to the work of Pamela Heaton, H-E-A-T-O-N, who works at Goldsmiths College in London, who's doing a lot of work with music and autism. One of the things that they found that's very interesting is it used to be thought that autistic people didn't necessarily have very strong emotional reactions to music because they don't verbalize about their emotions very much when they listen to music. But then when they actually attach physiological devices to them and study their responses, emotional responses physiologically, they see they have many of the same emotional responses to music. So music does seem to be getting into the, getting in there and reaching them. And that has important implications for how do you connect with an autistic person if you're doing therapy or education or what have you.
Does it have something to do with the connection between the auditory system and the autoimmune system?
Well, between the auditory system and the emotion systems of the brain, certainly. I'm trying to remember. Do you have something about autism in the book?
A little bit. The research seemed fairly preliminary to me, so I didn't write at length about it.
Mm-hmm.
I should say the autonomic nervous system and the auditory system is what I meant to say. I heard that there was a theories about a connection between those two systems that explained the effect on autistic patients.
I'm not so sure. I mean, one thing that is interesting, another thing that's interesting about autism in music is there's apparently a very high incidence of absolute pitch among autistic individuals, and that requires an explanation how they're listening to music in a somewhat different way, it seems, than many of us, because absolute pitch is extremely rare among neurologically normal individuals, 1 in 10,000, they think.
I wanted to get to this email from Benjamin in Portland. Regarding your story about the dancing parrot, I live in Portland, and as any native would tell you, parrots are not the only dancing animal. The Portland Zoo holds concerts frequently. Next to the concert lawn is the elephant exhibit. During the music, the elephants sway and move to the music. In fact, Ani Patel, you know a little bit about that.
Well, that's a wonderful observation because elephants are also vocal learners. They can imitate sound, so they do fit into this category of animals that we think may have this latent capacity for moving in time with a beat, as opposed to dogs or cats or horses or chimps that don't have this ability to imitate complex sounds, and we think they that cannot learn. So that's a wonderful anecdote. I'd like to see that myself.
We have this comment from Carolyn, who writes, could this new research help stop the decline of music instruction in our schools? Most schools faced with budget cuts eliminate music and or art instruction, even though the connection between music and mathematics proficiency has been shown. Nationwide, orchestras are being closed or consolidated. What will become of the civilized human without music instruction and exposure? Elena Manis, coming from your family, I would expect you would endorse that.
I certainly do, and it's one of my hopes that in a small way this book might encourage people to support music education in the schools. There are recent studies indicating that doing music, as Ani said, not just listening but singing or playing an instrument from a young age does have some effect on other cognitive abilities, such as verbal abilities, cognitive abilities, spatial reasoning. This is not proven yet, but there's, you know, significant evidence that doing music at a young age when we're kids may have long-term effects on other skills.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.